Introduction to Nothing for Nothing. Many times people come to me with ideas. Usually I can't use them for any of a variety of reasons. They don't appeal to me, perhaps, because they don't match my mindset. Or they would involve the kind of development I'm not particularly good at. Or I don't see consequences of the type that interest me. But once in a long, long while, something clicks. In July 1978, I was having lunch with Alexander Marshak, the Paleolithic archaeologist, at Tavern on the Green. He had, at that time, arranged an enormously successful display of Ice Age art at the Museum of Natural History. And he said to me, "Why don't you write a story, Isaac, about..." I listened to him in astonishment and said, "Alex, that's a great idea. I'll incorporate it into a story, but don't worry, I won't give you any credit." "That's all right," he said. But what the heck, I might as well. Nothing for Nothing was built up from his idea, which in turn came out of his dealings with Ice Age art, as you will see. I submitted it to George Sithers, and it appeared in the February 1979 Asimov's. Story 16. Nothing for Nothing. The scene was Earth. Not that the beings on the starship thought of it as Earth. To them it was a series of symbols stored in a computer. It was the third planet of a star located at a certain position with respect to the line connecting their home planet with the black hole that marked the galaxy's center and moving at a certain velocity with reference to it. The time was 15,000 BC, more or less. Not that the beings on the starship thought of it as 15,000 BC. To them, it was a certain period of time marked off according to their local system of measurement. The captain of the starship said, rather petulantly, "This is a waste of time. The planet is largely frozen. Let us leave." But the ship's explorer quietly said, "No, Captain." And that was that. As long as the starship was in space, or in hyperspace for that matter, the captain was supreme. But place that ship in orbit about a planet, and the explorer could not be challenged. He knew worlds. That was his specialty. And this explorer was in an impregnable position. He had what amounted to a sure instinct for profitable trade. It had been he and he alone who was responsible for the fact that this particular starship had won 3 awards for excellence for the work done in its last 3 expeditions. 3 for 3. So when the explorer said no, the captain could not dream of yes. Even in the unlikely case that he had, the crew would have mutinied. An award for excellence might be, to the captain, a pleasant spectral disc to suspend in the main salon, but to the crew it meant a spectacular addition to take-home pay, and an even more welcome addition to vacation time and pension benefits. And this explorer had brought them that 3 times. 3 for 3. The explorer said, "No strange world should be left unexamined." The captain said, "What is strange about this one?" "The preliminary probe shows intelligence, and on a frozen world."
"Surely that's not unprecedented."
"The pattern here is strange." The explorer looked uneasy. "I am not sure exactly how or exactly why, but the pattern of life and of intelligence is strange. We must examine it more carefully."
And that was that, of course.
There were at least 500,000,000,000 planetary worlds in the galaxy, if one only counted those associated with stars. Add to that the indefinite number moving independently through space, and the number might be 10 times as great. Even with computers to help, no starship could know them all. But an experienced explorer, by dint of lacking interest in anything else, of studying every exploratory report published, of considering endless correlations, and presumably playing with statistics even in his sleep, grew to have what seemed to others a mystical intuition about such things.
"We'll have to send out probes in full interlocking program," said the explorer.
The captain looked outraged. Full power meant a leisurely examination for weeks at enormous expense. He said, and it was as much as he could offer in the way of objection, "Is that absolutely necessary?" "I rather think so," said the explorer, with the self-confidence of one who knows his whim is law. The probes brought back exactly what the captain expected, and in great detail. An intelligent species, rather reminiscent, at least as far as superficial appearance went, of the lesser breeds of the inner proximal regions of the fifth arm of the galaxy. Not quite unusual, but of interest to mentologists, no doubt. As yet, the intelligent species was only at the first level of technology, long, long removed from anything useful. The captain said so, scarcely able to mask his exasperation, but the explorer, leafing through the reports, remained unmoved. He said, "Strange," and asked that the trader be summoned. This was really too much. A successful captain must never give a good explorer cause for unhappiness, but there are limits to everything. The captain said, fighting to keep the level of communication polite, if not friendly, "To what end, explorer? What can we expect at this level?"
"They have tools," said the explorer thoughtfully.
"Stone, bone, wood, or this planet's equivalent of that, and that's all. Surely we can find nothing in that."
"And yet there is something strange in the pattern."
"May I know what that might be, explorer?"
"If I knew what it might be, Captain, it would not be strange, and I would not have to find out. Really, Captain, I must insist on the traitor." The traitor was as indignant as the captain was, and had more scope to express it. His, after all, was a specialty as deep as that of anyone's on the starship, even in his own opinion, and in some others, as deep and essential as the explorer's. The captain might navigate a starship, and the explorer might detect useful civilizations by the most tenuous of signs. But in the final clutch, it was the trader and his team who faced the aliens and who plucked out of their minds and culture that which was useful, and gave in return something they found useful. And this was done at great risk. The alien ecology must not be disrupted. Alien intelligences must not be harmed, not even to save one's own life. There were good reasons for that on the cosmic scale, and traders were amply rewarded for the risks they ran. But why run useless risks? The trader said, "There is nothing there. My interpretation of the probe's data is that we're dealing with semi-intelligent animals. Their usefulness is nil. Their danger is great. We know how to deal with truly intelligent aliens, and trader teams are rarely killed by them. Who knows how these animals will react? And you know we are not allowed to defend ourselves properly." The explorer said, "These animals, if they are no more than that, have interestingly adapted themselves to the ice. There are subtle variations in the pattern here I do not understand. But my considered opinion is that they will not be dangerous, and that they may even be useful. I feel they are worth closer examination."
"What can be gained from a Stone Age intelligence?" asked the trader.
"That is for you to find out."
The trader thought grimly, "Of course, that is what it comes to, for us to find out."
He knew well the history and purpose of the starship expedition. There had been a time, 1,000,000 years before, when there had been no traders, explorers, or captains, but only ancestral animals with developing mind and a Stone Age technology, much like the animals on the world they were now orbiting. How slow the advance, how painfully slow the self-generated process, until the third-level civilization had been reached. Then had come the starships and the chance of cross-fertilization of cultures. Then had come progress. The trader said, "With respect, explorer, I grant your intuitional experience. Will you grant my practical experience, though it is less dramatic? There is no way in which anything below a third-level civilization can have anything we can use."
"That," said the explorer, "is a generalization that may or may not be true."
"With respect, explorer, it is true. And even if those semi-animals had something we could use, and I can't imagine what it might be, what can we give them in exchange?" The explorer was silent. The trader went on,
At this level, there is no way in which a proto-intelligence can accept an alien stimulation. The mentologists are agreed on that, and it is my experience too. Progress must be self-generated, until at least the second level is reached, and we must make a return. We can take nothing for nothing. The captain said, "And that makes sense, of course. By stimulating these intelligences to advance, we can harvest them again at a later visit." "I don't care about the reason for it," said the trader impatiently. "It is part of the tradition of my profession. We do no harm under any condition, and we give a return for what we take. Here, there is nothing we will want to take, and even if we find something, there will be nothing that we can give in return. We waste time." The explorer shook his head. "I ask you to visit some center of population, trader. I will abide by your decision when you return." And that was that, too. For 2 days, the small trader module flashed over the surface of the planet, searching for any evidence of a reasonable level of technology. There was none. A complete search could take years, but was scarcely worth it. It was unreasonable to suppose a high level would be hidden. The highest technology was always flaunted, for it had no enemy. That was the universal experience of traders everywhere. It was a beautiful planet, half frozen as it was. White and blue and green, wild and rough and variegated, crude and untouched. But it was not the trader's job to deal with beauty, and he shrugged off such thoughts impatiently. When his crew talked to him in such terms, he was short with them. He said, "We'll land here. It seems to be a good-sized concentration of the intelligences. We can do no better." His second said, "What can we do even with these, Maestro?" "You can record," said the trader. "Record the animals, both unintelligent and supposedly intelligent, and any artifact of theirs we can find. Make sure the records are thoroughly holographic." "We can already see," began the second. "We can already see," said the trader. "But we must have a record to convince our explorer out of his dreams, or we'll remain here forever." "He is a good explorer," said one of the crew. "He has been a good explorer," said the trader. "But does that mean he will be good forever? Perhaps his very successes have made him accept himself at too high an evaluation. So we must convince him of reality, if we can." They wore their suits when they emerged from the module. The planetary atmosphere would support them, but the feeling of exposure to the raw winds of an open planet would discommode them, even if the atmosphere and temperature were perfect, which they weren't. The gravity was a touch high, as was the light level, but they could bear it. The intelligent beings, dressed rather sketchily in the outer portions of other animals, retreated reluctantly at their approach and watched at a distance. The trader was relieved at this. Any sign of non-belligerence was welcome to those not permitted to defend themselves. The trader and his crew did not try to communicate directly or to make friendly gestures. Who knew what gesture might be considered friendly by an alien? The trader set up a mental field instead, and saturated it with the vibrations of harmlessness and peace, and hoped that the mental fields of the creatures were sufficiently advanced to respond. Perhaps they were, for a few crept back and watched motionlessly, as though intensely curious. The trader thought he detected fugitive thoughts, but that seemed unlikely for first-level beings, and he did not follow them up. Instead, he went stolidly about the business of making holographic reproductions of the vegetation, of a herd of blundering herbivores that appeared and then, deciding the surroundings were dangerous, thundered away. A large animal stood its ground for a while, exposing white weapons in a cavity at its forend, then left. The trader's crew worked as he did, moving methodically across the landscape. The call, directly mental, and surcharged with such emotion of surprise and awe that the informational content was all but blurred out, came unexpectedly. "Maestro, here, come quickly." Specific directions were not given. The trader had to follow the beam, which led into a crevice bounded by two rocky outcroppings.
Other members of the crew were converging, but the trader had arrived first.
"What is it?" asked the trader.
His second was standing in the glow of his suit radiation, in a deeply hollowed-out portion of the hillside. The trader looked about.
"This is a natural hollow, not a technological product."
"Yes, but look!"
The trader looked up, and for perhaps 5 seconds he was lost. Then he sent out a strenuous message for all others to stay away. He said, "Is this of technological origin?"
"Yes, Maestro.
You can see it is only partly completed."
"But by whom?"
"By those creatures out there, the intelligent ones. I found one at work in here. This is his light source. It was burning vegetation. These are his tools."
"And where is he?"
"He fled."
"Did you actually see him?"
"I recorded him." The trader pondered. Then he looked up again. "Have you ever seen anything like this?"
"No, Maestro."
"Or heard of anything like this?"
"No, Maestro."
"Astonishing." The trader showed no signs of wanting to withdraw his eyes, and the second said softly,
"Maestro, what do we do?"
"Eh?"
"This will surely win our ship still a fourth prize."
"Surely," said the trader regretfully, "if we could take it." The second said hesitantly,
"I have already recorded it."
"Eh? What is the use of that? We have nothing to give in exchange."
"But we have this. Give them anything."
The trader said, "What are you saying?
They are too primitive to accept anything we could give them. It will surely be nearly 1,000,000 years before they could possibly accept the suggestions of exogenous origin. We will have to destroy the recording."
"But we know, Maestro." "Then we must never talk about it. Our craft has its ethics and its traditions. You know that. Nothing for nothing."
"Even this?"
"Even this." The trader's sternly implacable set of expression was tinged with unbearable sorrow, and despite his "even this," he stood irresolute. The second sensed that. He said, "Try giving them something, Maestro."
"Of what use would that be?"
"Of what harm?" The trader said, "I have prepared a presentation for the entire starship, but I must show it to you first, Explorer, with deep respect and with apologies for masked thoughts. You were right, there was something strange about this planet. Though the intelligences on the planet were barely first level, and though their technology was primitive in the extreme, they had developed a concept we have never had, and one that, to my knowledge, we have never encountered on any other world." The captain said uneasily, "I cannot imagine what it might be." He was quite aware that traders sometimes overpraised their purchases to magnify their own worth. The explorer said nothing. He was the more uneasy of the two. The trader said, "It is a form of visual art."
"Playing with color?" asked the captain.
"And shape, but to most startling effect." He had arranged the holographic projector. "Observe." In the viewing space before them, a herd of animals appeared. Bulky, shaggy, two-horned, four-legged. They hesitated, then ran, dust spurting up beneath their hooves.
"Ugly object," muttered the captain.
The holographic recording brought the herd to a halt, clamped it down to a still. It magnified, and a single beast filled the view, its bulky head lowered, its nostrils distended. "Observe this animal," said the trader. "And now observe this artificial composition of a primitive concoction of oil and colored mineral, which we found smeared over the roof of a cave."
There it was again.
Not quite the animal as holographed. Flat, but vibrant.
What a peculiar similarity, said the captain. Not peculiar, said the trader. Deliberate. There were dozens of such figures in different poses, of different animals. The likenesses were too detailed to be fortuitous. Imagine the boldness of the conception, to place colors in pleasing shapes and combinations, and in such a way as to deceive the eye into thinking it is looking at a real object. These organisms have devised an art that represents reality. It is representational art, as I suppose we might call it. And that's not all. We found it done in three dimensions also. The trader produced an array of small figures in gray stone and in faintly yellow bone. These are clearly intended to represent themselves. The captain seemed stupefied. Did you see these manufactured? No, that I did not, Captain. One of my men saw a planetary being smearing color on one of the cave representations, but these we found already formed. Still, no other explanation is possible than that they were deliberately shaped. These objects could not have assumed these shapes by chance processes. The captain said, These are curious, but one doesn't follow the motive. Would not holographic techniques serve the purpose better? At such times as these are developed, of course. These primitives have no conception that holography could someday be developed, and could not wait the million years required. Then, too, maybe holography is not better. If you compare the representations with the originals, you will notice that the representations are simplified and distorted in subtle ways, designed to bring certain characteristics into focus. I believe this form of art improves on the original in some ways, and certainly has something different to say. The trader turned to the explorer. I stand in awe at your abilities. Can you explain how you sensed the uniqueness of this intelligence? The explorer signed a negative. I did not suspect this at all. It is interesting, and I see its worth, although I wonder if we could ourselves properly control our colors and shapes in order to force them into such representational form. Yet this does match the unease within me. What I wonder is how you came into possession of these. What did you give in exchange? It is there. I see the strangeness lie. Well, said the trader, in a way, you're right. Quite strange. I did not think I could give anything, since the organisms are so primitive. But this discovery seemed too important to sacrifice without some effort. I therefore chose from among the group of beings who formed these objects, one whose mental field seemed somewhat more intense than that of the others, and attempted to transfer to him a gift in exchange. And succeeded? Of course, said the explorer. Yes, I succeeded, said the trader happily, failing to notice that the explorer had made a statement and had not asked a question. The beings, the trader went on, kill such animals as they represent in color by throwing long sticks tipped with sharpened stone. These penetrate the hide of the animals, wound and weaken them. They can then be killed by the beings who are individually smaller and weaker than the animal they hunt. I pointed out that a smaller, stone-tipped stick could be hurled forward with greater force and effect, and with longer range, if a cord under tension were used as a mechanism of propulsion. The explorer said, Such devices have been encountered among primitive intelligences, which were, however, far advanced beyond these. Paleomantologists call it a bow and arrow. The captain said, How could the knowledge be absorbed? It couldn't be at this level of development. But it was, unmistakably. The response of the mental field was one of insight at almost unbearable intensity. Surely you do not think I would have taken these art objects, were they 20 times as valuable, if I had not been convinced that I had made a return? Nothing for nothing, Captain. The explorer said in a low, despondent voice, There is the strangeness, to accept. The captain said, But surely, trader, we cannot do this. They are not ready. We are harming them. They will use the bow and arrow to wound each other, and not the beasts alone. The trader said, "We do not harm them, and we did not harm them. What they do to each other, and where they end as a result, a million years from now, is not our concern." The captain and the trader left to set up the demonstration for the starship's company, and the explorer said sadly in the direction in which they had gone, "But they accepted, and they flourish amid the ice, and in 20,000 years it will be our concern." He knew they would not believe him, and he despaired.